Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I consider it a great privilege to have been invited here tonight to address you regarding an organization that really does not need any promotion or sales pitch or convincing. Anything that we do here tonight is superfluous and extra. And I'm also, as I always say, uncomfortable when I speak here in the holy city of Muncie. What am I gonna say that you don't already know? The people here, Baruch Hashem, are well-versed. Talmidei Chachamim, Tzaddikim. I come from a small town called Brooklyn. What is a guy from Brooklyn going to teach somebody from Muncie? So I'm going and knowing that, but nonetheless, out of respect to Mr. Rosenstock and all the other great members of Tumchei Shabbat, or Shabbos as you say. So I came to say a Devre Torah in their honor and as well as yours. There's an old question that has been asked by the Rishonim, the Ramban, Rashi asks it. It's been asked by Aharonim, the later rabbis, and even the Ahare Aharonim. Anybody that went through the story of Mitzrayim or Yitziat Mitzrayim has grappled with this question. And the question is well known. They're all trying to figure out the numbers. God told Avraham Avinu that it's going to take 400 years to be in Egypt. It's a pasuk in the Torah. Arba me'ot shana. There's no way to misunderstand that word. Arba me'ot shana. It's 400 years. Those are God's words. However, when you do the math, it seems that the Jewish people were in Egypt for only 210 years. And here comes the big question, how did 400 become 210? It's an old question. Many answers have been given. Some of the famous answers, well, one answer that the Gaon Mevilna said was that they worked so hard in Egypt that the work was so excruciating, like the Pasuk says, "Vaymareru et hayehem." So they were able to do 400 years of work in half the time. It's almost like when you make an extra payment on your mortgage and 30 years somehow becomes 15 years. Others explain that no, it wasn't necessarily that they worked extra hard, but there were so many people. There was a population explosion. As the Pasuk says, the ladies were giving birth to six at a time. So therefore you had so many people, so they were able to get the job done that much quicker. So again, 400 years work, because of the population, was expedited in half the time. I won't go through all the answers, but this one answer caught my attention, and I'd like to embellish it a little. The answer that I found was in a sefer called Arugot HaBosel. He makes an observation. He says that when Moshe Rabbeinu came to the burning bush, so God tells him that he has to take out the Jewish people from Egypt. And I heard their pain and I feel their pain, and it's incumbent upon you to do this. And then he tells Moshe Rabbeinu, but don't worry, they're not going to leave empty-handed. The Jews are going to leave with the money, although Moshe never asked anything about the money. Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't asking about compensation, but God made it a point to say that when they leave, they won't leave rekam. They won't leave empty-handed. And then God says, how? How is that going to manifest? V'sha'ala isha v'shichinta u'migarat beta kele kesef v'chle zahab u'smalot. That the Jews will go to their Egyptian neighbors and they will borrow, which we know it was a borrowing where we didn't have to return it, but they will borrow gold and silver and garments. That's how they're going to leave. That's where they're going to get the money from. Although Moshe Rabbeinu didn't ask about this compensation, but God said, that's going to happen. Listen to the terminology. V'sha'ala isha m'shechinta. Shechinta means a neighbor. But I made the following observation. In this week's parasha, you'll notice, parashat bo, that when they're in Egypt, so Moshe Rabbeinu says to the people that we're about to leave, but before we leave, the yishalu ish me'et re'ehu kele kesef uchle zahav, that don't forget, we have to borrow ish me'et re'ehu, man to his colleague, to his friend. And I always assumed, well, that was Moshe Rabbeinu telling the people what God had told them at the burning bush. That was the condition that's going to happen before they leave. But I made a simple observation, and I'm sure you're thinking of it now. There's a difference between the word shechinta, your neighbor, and re'ehu. Re'ehu means a friend. God never told Moshe about re'ehu. He said, you're going to take property and assets from your Egyptian neighbors. Why did Moshe Rabbeinu then say, ish me'et re'ehu? How did a shechina turn into re'ehu? With great humility, and I don't say you have to accept what I'm going to say. I didn't put it through 13 filters to make sure what I'm saying doesn't contradict something else that's written somewhere. But I'm just coming tonight to say an idea. But you cannot deny that my observation is correct. God said, Shechinta, your neighbor, and Moshe Rabbeinu says, Re'ehu. And here's the theory. It's true, the Jews live next to the Egyptians. It's always been that way. Any neighborhood you go where there's Jews, there's always an Egyptian neighbor. And I'm assuming also that the Egyptian people, not all of them were wealthy. In every society you have wealthy people, and you have middle class people, and then you have the lower class people. So not every Jew lived next to a rich Egyptian. I think that's fair to say. So it's probable what happened was that they got that directive. Go to your neighbor and take their gold and their silver and their dresses. Well, if you were lucky and you lived next to somebody that was a rich Egyptian, so you hit a home run. You came out with a set of china and lalique glass and all these amenities, gold and silver, dresses with designers on it and everything. But if you weren't as fortunate, you end up living next to a poor Egyptian, you came out with a bag of beans. You came out with some flour, with some spices. Now clearly it's not fair, because you probably have people that worked in Egypt who had big families, and they come out with a bag of beans, and then you have somebody else that didn't work as hard, didn't have such a big family, and he, because of his rich neighbor, ends up coming out with something much more valuable. So you had a situation in Egypt that when they were leaving, there were Jews that were haves, and there were Jews that were have-nots, just based on where they lived. They couldn't pick their neighbors. So now imagine this. Moshe Rabbeinu says to the Jewish people, I understood what God meant when he was telling me that we're not going to leave empty-handed. He was telling me that something has to happen to trigger the redemption. And it's not that we're going to go to our Egyptian neighbors and take what they give us. That's only half the story. Now comes the challenge. V'yish'alu ish me'et re'ehu. Now the Jews, the ones that were able to take a lot and have more, let them share their windfall with their ehu. Let them share their profits with the ones that were not as fortunate. And once that happens, then already we have activated an exodus, a redemption. God said shechita, but Moshe Rabbeinu understood that the real redemption is going to take place when the booty is divided, the spoils are divided by the ehu, by the Jews themselves. When the haves tend to the needs of the have-nots. That's where the Gemula is. Well, if that's the case, there's three terminologies that I'd like to give basic definitions to. It's important that we know these terminologies. We've heard of all these words, but it's important to know the distinction between them. One word is called sympathy. One word is called empathy. And the other word is called apathy. Well, a simple explanation. Sympathy is when somebody can relate to somebody else's pain. And they feel for it, and they feel bad, and they can understand it. Usually, sympathetic people will react when they hear something. They'll say, they'll do that a few times, and they'll say, oh, what a shame, that's terrible. Maybe they'll even go and buy a Hallmark card with some sympathetic phrase on it and send it and say, you know, thinking about you, you know, wish things will work out. That's sympathy. It's not bad at all. It's a good midah. Empathy is a little higher. Empathy is not only that you can understand somebody's pain, but you actually put yourself in their position where you actually feel the pain as if it's your own. It's a much higher level. I have an example for this, which I'll give you in a minute. Apathy is where you show no concern. Where you're apathetic. Doesn't matter what anybody else's problems are, it doesn't concern you in the least. As long as it's not your problem and doesn't affect you directly, you have an apathetic mentality. Now, when did I learn the definitions of these three? I was on a flight coming back from, I guess it was from Miami to New York, to JFK. And we had just boarded in Fort Lauderdale, and it was a full flight. And we were still on the tarmac, and all of a sudden, I guess it was a baby or an infant, in the back of the plane started screaming on top of his lungs, or her lungs, screaming, crying. And you know, after 1 minute, 2 minute, 3 minute, and the baby's going on and on and on. And all of a sudden you start to see a couple of the people sitting in the front of the plane, they're pushing their button for the stewardess. The stewardess comes running and the man says, shut that baby up or throw her off the plane. We cannot be comfortable. We cannot sit on a plane like this for 2.5 hours where this baby's going to be shrieking the whole time. She has no right to bring a baby like this on the plane. We paid money for these seats over here. Then I said, that's apathy. And then I saw some young mothers that were also sitting, you know, around, and they were saying, that poor baby, that poor mother, she doesn't know how to get that baby to stop crying. Oh, that is so terrible. And then I said, oh, at least there's some sympathetic people on the plane. But then the following happened. Since the plane was still parked at the gate, all of a sudden, it couldn't have been more than a 3-year-old little boy was sitting towards the front of the plane, got out of his seat, and is walking very, very slowly to the back of the plane. And everybody is looking at this child as if he knows exactly where he's going, and he's trying to locate where the crying is coming from. And he keeps on looking into each row to see where the crying is, and finally he's able to locate it. and he sticks his head into that row of seats, and all of a sudden he sticks his hand in his pocket and he pulls out a lollipop. And he gives the child a lollipop, and immediately the child stops crying, and immediately the entire plane starts to give the child a standing ovation. And I said, that's the only child on the plane that had empathy. Which means he didn't only just feel bad, but he felt the pain enough to give his lollipop, which to a child is a treasure, in order to alleviate somebody else's pain. He took from himself. It wasn't just empty words or cliches of showing sympathy, but he did something. Says the Arugot HaBosar, the Jewish people were in Egypt, it's true. And they were working in the pits, and they were suffering. But you know what happened? They would look to their right, and they would see their friend that they knew from childhood that was also doing the same work that he did. And they felt bad for them. And they said, it's one thing that I have to do this work, but my friend also has to do this work. So every Jew had not only pain and suffering and agony for their own situation, but they felt the pain of the guy next to them. Says Arugot HaBosar. And the proof of this is because when they left Egypt and they saw their friend who worked next to them didn't get as much money as they did, they didn't say, well, it's Minas Shamayim, we're the haves and they're the have-nots, that's God's business. They said, no way. The empathy of Klal Yisrael was on the way out, even though they could have justified of keeping that money. After all, they did work for so many years without any compensation. And instead, the money that they took from the Shechinim, they ended up dividing amongst the Re'im. And as a result of that, every Jew suffered twice. Once for themselves and once for their neighbor. And as a result of that, every Jew worked twice. The agony was doubled. And therefore the exile was halved. 400 years of pain and suffering was cut in half because Jews were not selfish, because they were concerned about the next guy. And even when it meant to put money in their pocket and take money that they got fair and square, just to make the other guy feel equal. And they did that. God said, now the Jews are ready for a redemption. Not only are they ready for redemption, they're going to get a 50% discount on the exile. Well, if that's the case, so then I believe what the good people at Tumche Shabbat are doing, they're involved in something much more and much greater than just giving out alms and food and provisions for needy people. They are activating the concept of empathy. Or as Hachamim referred to it as, Noseh Be'ol. And as a result of that, if Egypt is the model, which it is, of all exiles, and if Egypt is the model of all redemptions, then it seems that the redemption is dependent that once the Jewish people can put their hands in their pockets and give some of their money to the have-nots. Money that can be shared amongst Re'im, Ish El Re'ehu, that activates redemption. And this organization is our proxy that is taking money from the haves and is seeing that that money is given to the have-nots, at least at this moment. And if anybody paid attention, and I go to a lot of dinners, and, you know, I listen to all the speeches, and more or less they're all the same, just with different names and different details. But tonight I was quite impressed when one of the heads of your organization got up here and told about a letter that he received. Not the $9, the 9 crumpled dollars. That's impressive also. But the letter that he just received about the fellow that got a stroke, blind, is a horror story. The family's getting evicted. And as he's telling the story, he talks about his response. And he tells you his oral response. And he says, we'll be there for you and we're going to make sure that you don't get evicted. It's January 16th. Today is January 6th. That means there's an eviction in 10 days. This lady didn't go through enough. And he didn't tell you half the story. So I know some of the details that it wasn't appropriate for him to tell you. And then in the middle of the story, the man cannot even continue to talk. And he's heard everything. This is not the first tragic stories. Right? That's what they do, these people. All day long is they hear tragic stories. And the man at his dinner cannot finish his speech and has to walk off the pulpit sobbing and crying because he cannot tolerate such pain. That's empathy. What is our reaction to this story? Well, I'll tell you one thing I didn't feel in this room. I didn't feel any apathy, thank God. You wouldn't be here tonight if you were apathetic. Well, some of us might have reacted with some sympathy. It's a terrible case. That poor lady, it's not enough what happened to her husband. It's not enough that she has single children at home. Now she's going to be evicted. Poor thing. No, it's good we have Alan over here to take care of it. But the call of the night is, V'yish'alu ish me'et re'ehu. Here we have a classic example that history is repeating itself. There is somebody that has now revealed to us that they're in need. And thank God we have taken from Galut America, our American neighbors has given us great wealth, some of us. And if it's not great wealth, at least we have. The response tonight is not sympathy. The response tonight must be empathy. I don't know why. It's a shame that he finished his speech prematurely. I want to know the numbers. What does this lady need? What is her rent? What are the numbers? If I'm not mistaken, could her rent be $2,500 a month? That sounds reasonable. So $2,500 a month times 12? What are we talking? How much money is this? $50,000? Amongst all these members that are here tonight? It would be worth it just to come to such a dinner to alleviate this one case. And then we could turn to God Almighty and we could say, God, you were able to turn 400 years into 200 because people were worried about somebody else. And that's why when they came to redeem us in Egypt, the Redeemer used two words, pakod pakadati, which means God says, I remembered. Well, he's talking about that he remembered us. But I asked a simple question, why the double language? Well, you know, God works with a measure for measure. God says, pakod pakadati means I remembered you quickly. I didn't pakod. If it would have been pakod, it would have taken 400 years. But pakod pakadati, it was expedited. It was done quickly. It was a pakod pakadati. You know why? Because you fulfilled pakod pakadati. You didn't only remember yourself. You remembered the guy next door. And when Klal Yisrael involves himself in pakod pakadati, then God involves himself in pakod pakadati. And then the galut is halved. Now there must be a number in heaven how long this galut is supposed to last. It's pushing 2,000 years. I don't know the number. But I've learned from this parasha how to get the discount. How to shave that number down. How to cut the number of exile. And with this I understand something else. If you'll allow me to say something that I read from the great Rabbi Rabbi Yaakov Al-Ghazi in his Haggadah Shel Pesach. He says, you remember those five rabbis in Bnei Berak that we all read about? Ma'aseh bin Rabbi Eliezer, bin Rabbi Yoshua, bin Rabbi Elazar bin Azariah, bin Rabbi Akiva, bin Rabbi Tarfon. Shayu misulim bin Bnei Berak. They spent Pesach in Bnei Berak. In those days they didn't have trips in the, Miami or wherever. That's That's where they used to go, B'nai Berak. And the five rabbis are there at the Seder, and it says, V'hayu mesapirim b'siyat Mitzrayim kodoto alayla. And they were telling the story of Yitziyat Mitzrayim. Rabbi Al-Ghazi says, what were they telling? It doesn't say what they were saying. It would be nice to know what topic did they choose to speak on that night. So he says, well, in his theory, they were talking exactly what we're talking about tonight. They were trying to make the calculation of why Yitziyat Mitzrayim happened early. So he says, if you take the word Mesaprim, Mesaprim could mean they were telling over, they were telling a story. But Mesaperim also comes from the Hebrew word Mispar. Mispar is a number. Shehayu Mesaperim, they were calculating. Bishiyat Mitzrayim, they were calculating with Misparim, with numbers. Why did we leave so early? That was the discussion of the entire night, making the calculation. Says Rav Chida, our great rabbi Rav Chida, he says, V'chol ha-marbeh l'saper b'siyat Mitzrayim, ha-rezeh m'shubah. He says, and anybody that involves himself, not only in the telling over of the story of Mitzrayim is praiseworthy, but kol ha-marbeh l'saper, anybody that involves himself in the numbers, trying to figure out, to reconcile how 400 became 210, kol ha-marbeh l'saper, if you're involved in the mispar, in the number, you are praiseworthy. Why should you be praiseworthy? Because you're a mathematician? Why should you be praiseworthy? And the explanation is because you'll come to this truth that we learned here tonight. That galut is cut in half. The mispar of 400 becomes 210 because ish et re'ehu yomar hazak ya'azoru. Ish et re'ehu ya'azoru. That when man helps his friend, when the haves help the have-nots, galut dissipates. Therefore, if you learn the lesson of the mispar, if you learn the lesson of what happened in Egypt, kol ha-marbeh l'saper, when you do this calculation, you become a better person. Because then you will emulate our forefathers in Egypt. And you will not only borrow from your Egyptian neighbor, that's the easy part. But then what you've taken from the Egyptian neighbor, you will make sure that your Jewish neighbor is not lacking and has at least his basic needs. So Tomche Shabbat is involved in shaving off time from the exile. And here tonight we have an opportunity for 40, 50,000 bucks that can be raised over here. In my community, we raise that in an elevator. This can be raised over here in a minute. Just each guy comes along and says, I give 1,000, 2,000, 5,000, 1 month rent, 2 months. Should we leave here tonight and leave that letter just with words? She didn't write a letter so she can get a response with words that we feel bad, we're sorry, it's so tragic, it's terrible. That's sympathy. Sympathy doesn't pay the bills. She wrote that letter for empathy. And this is the challenge that we have here tonight. Can we walk out of here tonight at least to solve, to take one of Alan's cases off his desk? I'm sure, ki lo yichdal evyon, there'll be more letters, but to take one, and by no means, I came here tonight to make a speech. I didn't come here tonight to make a donation, but I did bring a check with me, my own personal check. And I intended to give a small donation. But now that I heard this story and Alan's heartfelt presentation of it, and I'm not a wealthy man by any square of the imagination, but I am willing to give of my own money $1,000 towards this project itself. And I hope that people that are better suited than I am, that we'll see if the rabbi can give that money, and he's going to have to make a lot of speeches to make up for that money, for the ma'aser at least, then you will do the same. And then, I have no doubt, Borei Olam in heaven will say, look at this, look at this. Angels in heaven, it says that the galut is supposed to last so many more years. Split that number. And the angel will say, why? Because Am Yisrael has learned the lesson. They have made the calculation. They have been marbeh saper. They have made the calculation of the 400 to the 200. And as a result, havezeh meshubach. Thank you very much.